to reach workers. And in doing so, I've like built a model, this small shop model that can link all of these different places. Unions have not often, have sometimes shied away from places where you have to go shop by shop by shop in this small way, instead of a big kind of central place to organize a bunch of folks. And they've showed it can be done.
Despite the wins, however, there are some big challenges ahead. As we saw in the Little Dog story, voting to form a union is sometimes the easy part.
Especially against the largest corporations like Starbucks and Amazon, how do you translate that into contract wins? Because these companies have so much money to burn on anti-union organizing, on illegal tactics that then get fined and then they pay like $8,000. So I think that points to the need to reform the actual labor laws and structures that get us from the vote to the actual contract.
That was Robert Schlela, assistant professor of urban sociology at Cal State Long Beach and a visiting researcher at the UCLA Labor Center. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like more information about today's program, please visit us online at radioproject.org or leave us a comment on our socials. Our Twitter is making_contact and on Instagram, we're Making Contact Radio Project. I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.
This is Making Contact, and I'm Anita Johnson. And I just love talking to comedians. I appreciate how they bring their personal life experiences to the stage and allow us to laugh with them. The funniest jokes are the ones that we can relate to, the ones that bring us back to the moments we've gone through in life. And comics that are vulnerable in exploring those real life moments use comedy as a tool to tell the truth about society, about culture, and about all things that are happening around them. My next guest, Corinda Dobbins, is that kind of comedian. Corinda's debut album is called Black and Blue. And in all her lighthearted humor, she has a way of making us reflect on serious issues like COVID.
One of my first shows I did after, you know, we got out of lockdown, I was doing a show and I was at the bar trying to turn in my drink ticket because, you know, that's how they usually pay us. So I was there trying to get my payment. And this guy was at the bar. He was eating his food and I was letting him know, you know, that I was staying safe. I was like, sir, I'm going to be 6 feet away from you. Like, I'm not going to breathe on your food. Everything's good. And he said to me, well, if it's in the air, it's in the air. And I didn't want to get pulled into this conversation, but now I have to. I was like, excuse me, sir, what do you mean? He was like, well, if COVID is in the air, it's in the air. And if it's as dangerous as they say it is, these flies are flying around in the air. How come these flies ain't dropping dead from COVID? And I didn't have an answer for that. I didn't have nothing. But I was up at 12:30 at night Googling, do flies drop dead from COVID? Because I got to have an answer for these people when they come up to me in public. So now, if I ever run into that guy again, I'll be like, well, sir, COVID is a respiratory disease, and flies don't have lungs. So no, these flies ain't dropping dead from COVID out here.
That's Corinda sparking laughs in the room. I spoke with her last week about her comedy album, Black and Blue, and what it meant to record her album during such unprecedented times, post-COVID restrictions.
Yeah, we recorded the album right sort of at the end of the pandemic in San Francisco at the Punchline. And my best friend in comedy, Daya Lakshman-Ryan, and I, we both recorded our albums on the same night. And it was a great night. I think it was a good time because people were really ready to get out of the house and people were really ready to laugh again. And I was glad that we could do that in San Francisco.
Absolutely. You know, at the top of this conversation, in my introduction regarding who you are, where you come from, your comedy chops, early beginnings, I played for the listening audience of making contact. I got to have an answer. Bringing into this conversation, aside from having an answer, what else did the pandemic teach you?
Wow, so many things. I think one of the things it taught me is that, you know, your health is your number one priority in life. We get caught up with so many things, but, you know, they say health is wealth. And I think the pandemic bore that out because so many people lost so many people that were close to them. And I think one of the other things it taught me is that I really don't need a lot to be happy. You know, we were confined to our house and we were just making art, creating, writing out in the yard with the plants and the, you know, the garden. And, you know, it was just, it was kind of a, you know, when people say a simpler time, that's really what it was for us.
You know, I hear that the event drew a diverse crowd with a lot of Black and Brown faces in the audience. As a Black comedian who spent over a decade living in the Bay Area, and that's Northern California for folks that don't know, in what ways have you personally been affected by the decline of San Francisco's Black population and the city's increasing lack of diversity? And I ask this question knowing that you no longer live in the Bay Area. You're in Southern Cal now, am I correct?
Right. I'm mostly in Southern Cal, but I do come back to the Bay. But, you know, when we taped our special, it was really a delight because Daya, obviously, she's Indian and I'm Black, and we wanted to bring Black and Brown people to San Francisco because, like you said, when I started 10 years ago, our audiences looked very different. And now because of, you know, gentrification and because of, you know, the cost of living in San Francisco and in Oakland, our audiences are very, you know, tech bro kind of, everybody's just kind of homogenous. And so I think it affects the comedy. I think it affects the type of comedy that you can do, because a lot of times as people of color, you know, we don't have to do a lot of the legwork on certain jokes because they just know. And at the top, we just get right to the chase. And so if you don't have diverse audiences, there's a lot more background that you have to do on certain jokes. And so it's definitely been had a negative effect on comics who used to have more diverse audiences in San Francisco and Oakland, East Bay in general.
And what you're referring to is really like setting up the joke work in a sense of like something that should normally take maybe 30 seconds now might take a minute and a half.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't have that connection and people don't already know. It's like you got to do more, a little more work to explain what you're talking about.
Right. You know, Black and Blue largely speaks on your experiences navigating. You know, you're talking about navigating these spaces just right now, right? In a sense of the legwork. When we think about navigating these spaces, mainly due to their lack of inclusivity, do you feel that comedy is a way of processing the trauma you've experienced in these non-inclusive spaces such as Hollywood, the biotech industry, and the rapidly gentrifying New Oakland?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And as you know, a lot of Black people can't afford therapy. So I definitely work it out on stage. It's very cathartic. I mean, you get to go up there and tell your truth in a funny way. And, you know, hopefully people relate to it. And yeah, the stage is definitely where, you know, you get all of that out.
And, you know, since we're talking about Oakland's rapidly changing demographics, let's play a bit from the CD, Black and Blue. It's Old Oakland versus New Oakland off of the CD, Black and Blue.
Black women out here doing all kind of stuff we don't think they would be doing. I injured myself last year, and I'm sure you know if you injure yourself in California, you got to do yoga. Like, that's, I think that's in the charter of the state. And I was like, I don't want to do yoga. But I had to find a yoga class that speaks to my heart. So I do trap yoga. A lot of people was like, trap yoga, that doesn't sound like that go together. But you didn't think sushi and a burrito went together either, but you probably have one every day. You know, sushi burrito. I love trap yoga. My teacher, she's from Oakland, but she studied in India, so she's a certified vinyasa yoga instructor. But her class is styled a little different, you know what I mean? Like, she's walking around surveying the class. She's like, this class is about to be real hard. And she's giving you little ratchet affirmations in between your yoga stances. You're like coming up out of Young Cobra or whatever, and she's like, I want you to stay loose. I'm like, okay, I'm staying loose. She's like, I want you to bend over. I'm like, oh, well, righty. She's like, I want you to look over your left shoulder. I was like, oh, what's over my left shoulder? She's like, I want you to look over your left shoulder, and I want you to say goodbye to being a side chick in your own life. I was like, oh my God, I always should have been in this class. You coming up out of the next dance, and she's like, I still want you to stay loose. I'm like, okay, I'm staying loose. She's like, I want you to bend over again. I'm like, all righty. She's like, but this time I want you to look over your right shoulder. I'm like, oh, what's over my right shoulder? She said, I want you to look over your right shoulder, and I want you to say goodbye to all the you let slide. I was like, lady, I don't even know you, but you saying right through me. It's very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable. But my favorite is I was trying to do upward facing dog. I'm sure you guys know it's kind of difficult to do upward facing dog. And this is how I was doing it. I was like, she was like, that ain't it. I was like, but I'm trying though. And for some reason, I just started grunting even though I was doing the position wrong. And I was like, She was like, I want you to bend over backwards for your self for once. I was like, oh! Almost broke my spine for that lady. I love that class. What kind of yoga do y'all do, San Francisco? Goat yoga? I heard about it. Naked. Naked yoga? Naked goat yoga, okay. I thought trap yoga was different.
Now, Corinda, in your stand-up, you talk about racism, the racism that you've experienced in your life, experiences that can be viewed as absurd or highly offensive in nature. What's the process for you as a comedian turning the absurd into funny? And I ask that because in your debut comedy CD, Black and Blue, you have a bit called Not My Harriet, referring to Harriet Tubman, the American abolitionist and social activist. One part that stood out for me was when you talked about made out of leather and contradictions. Talk a bit about I love that. I love that. It was like I just like in and mic drop.
Yes.
Talk a bit about your process of creating as an artist, especially when we think about taking the absurd and turning it into funny.
Oh man, but that's been the story of Black comedy since we got here. I think the ability to take our experiences and the absurdity and the pain and all of the things that happened to us and be able to turn that into something relatable and funny and, as you said, point out the absurdities and things, that's hugely gratifying for me because so many times people take our experience and they make fun of it without really keeping the pain in it. So it's kind of tricky to do both of those things. It's like, yeah, I want you to see the absurdity of this, and I want to make you laugh, but I also want you to feel the pain of it a little bit. And that's, you know, the line that we all kind of walk in comedy.
Being that we're talking about Not My Harriet, let's listen to it. It's track 9 on the comedy CD, Black and Blue. Again, this is Making Contact. Stay tuned.
Black women trying to hurry up and get Harriet on that $20 bill. They said it might take till 2030. Black women's like, no. But I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know how I feel about Harriet being on the $20 bill. Because on one hand, I get it. In this country, when you do great things, they want to try to put you on money. You know what I mean? That's how they memorialize you. But on the other hand, Harriet was fighting for Black people not to be a type of currency, so I don't know how she would feel about being on money. You know, and I don't want people throwing Harriets at the strip club. I don't want that. I don't want people using Harriets for the drug deal. You know what I mean? That's disrespectful. I don't want rappers talking about dead Harriets. Like, I don't want that. How about we put Harriet on a coin? Let's do that. Let's put Harriet on the coin. You know why? You know what people do with coins? They polish it. They put it in a little sleeve. And they put it in the drawer. And keep her safe. That's what I want for Harriet. That's what I want. And they're talking about putting Andrew Jackson on the back, putting Harriet on the front. No. That's what we're not going to do. Yeah, you gonna put a white dude on the back? Harriet got to watch her back the whole time she on the $20 bill? Y'all gonna have to find a picture of Harriet running like this, like have a pair of Air Jacksons on, just like made out of leather and contradictions. I don't know.
You're listening to a conversation I had with comedian Corinda Dobbins about her debut CD, Black and Blue on Making Contact. To stay up to date with our shows and get more information about the person profiled in this week's episode, visit us on social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter at FOCmedia_org. That's FOCmedia_ORG. Now back to the show. Now, reading your bio, I learned that you entered into this comedic space off of a dare from a friend. And that's peer pressure at its finest, because it led you from an open mic night to sharing the stage with notable comedians such as Roy Wood Jr. and Gina Yashere. Now, what I wanted to kind of understand is, how has your identity been received throughout your years in the Black comedic space, both as a woman, but then also as a lesbian?
Wow, You know, I always say that I always try to bring my full self, my full comedic self, no matter where I am. And there may be times I've done a predominantly gay audience, and they may not have necessarily wanted me to talk about, you know, my Blackness and sort of how that's informed my comedy. And I've been in Black comedic spaces where they don't necessarily want to hear about me being a lesbian. So in every space, and corporate spaces where they don't want to hear about either. So I've tried to bring my full self in on every stage that I come to. And I feel like as long as I can make my personal experiences funny, that usually overcomes some of the pushback I get from being my full self.
It sounds really interesting just to hear you describe it as such, because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, it's almost like, what do I bring to the cookout?
Right. I mean, it's always a navigation that you're going to have to do in any space that you're in. I mean, as Black women, we know how to do that. I mean, I did it in corporate America. I've done it in comedy. And there's always a feeling that a lot of times Black women are too much. And so a lot of times we sort of pull back on the fullness of who we are. And I have done that at times, but as I've gotten older and I've gotten more years under my belt in comedy, it's like, no, I want to bring the fullness of who I am to whatever space I'm in. And so I try to do that every time I step on stage.
Before the break, Corinda talked about what it's like being a Black woman comedian in certain spaces. I wanted to ask her about another piece of her identity, being a Black lesbian specifically.
I was single for a long time, and I'm sure you guys know why. I wanted a woman who didn't have a pet. That's a tough go. But I finally found a woman who didn't have a pet. As soon as she told me she didn't have a pet, like, I just dropped down to one knee. I was like, you're the one for me. I don't know if we're ever gonna get married, but I don't know. I don't like lesbian weddings. Because they're all outside of the woods. So I don't like that. It's cold. Every lesbian wedding I've been to has been in the woods. And they're very long. They all start out something like this, like you're walking in and they're like, yes, Tracy, please start reading the 300-word passage from the little-known 19th century feminist we've never heard of. Go. Uh-huh. And then after you're done, please start the 3-hour African drum circle. And their vows always start out like this. We met. Our souls met. 1,000 years ago. In another lifetime. But I knew our souls would meet again in this one. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, I crawl out of every lesbian wedding looking like Leonardo DiCaprio from The Revenant. It's just a beard. Crawling out of that shallow gray. I got a bear coat on me. Like, oh, what year is it? It's cold. And every time you go to a lesbian wedding, you got to go to REI. I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a map on the wall at REI, and you just point to the woodsy area your lesbian wedding is gonna be at, and they just give you the shoes for that terrain. Be like, yeah, it's gonna be muddy. Just get ready to slog uphill. Just.
Now, when I first heard this, I mentioned how much I appreciated the not my Harriet bit, but then wedding in the woods, me being a self-identified Black queer woman, right? Oh, no, she didn't, right? It was a whole moment. I'm like, oh, my goodness.
I was fed up when I wrote that joke. I mean, I literally had been to like 10 weddings in the woods. I was like, that's enough.
I mean, it's like, if that's the thing for me, it's like, okay, so I'm listening to it. What's the difference for you as a comedian between the stereotype and the archetype, especially when creating a joke? Because, you know, if somebody who wasn't a lesbian did that, it could be seen as offensive, right?
But you, right. I mean, I lived it. I think that's the difference, right? Because if you're taking the stereotype and you haven't lived it, or at least been adjacent to it, I mean, I think that's when it gets problematic. But, you know, they say all stereotypes are rooted in some truth, but then I think if you live in the truth, then, you know, it's always going to be funny.
No, absolutely. It's like, I'm a complex individual. I am this, you know, multifaceted. I have multi-layered personality in the sense of you're Black, you're a woman, you know, you're queer, you know, you're mm-hmm. this biotech person. Now you're entering into this writer, comedic space, as well right. as actor. Backing up a bit for the listening audience, though, we talked about how you entered the comedy space solely from a dare, from a friend. But I think for many people who are not comedians, and I'm not a comedian, but I have, you know, friends that are, you know, like, I have friends that are Black. You mm-hmm.
know? I have some funny people in my life. Yeah.
You know, and they tell me about this process, because you're shifting from one world to the other and then trying to process things on a regular basis. And it's extremely difficult and can be challenging if you're not dedicated to the craft. Now, being on stage in particular, thinking about an open mic night, how has the navigation of these spaces helped you to hone your craft, especially now at this point of your career?
I mean, you just got to do the work, man. I mean, I cut my comedic chops in San Francisco, but almost every comic who comes up in the Bay, I mean, you have to move in order to take the next step in your career. And some people choose to move to New York. I chose LA because I grew up in Detroit and I didn't want to go back to the cold. So I was like, let me see what's popping in LA. And, you know, once you get down here, it's a different beast. Hollywood is, there are so many ways that you can go in Hollywood, right? You can come down here and you can just try to make it in stand-up, or you can come down and you can try to be a writer on a comedy show, or you can come down and you can try to sell a pilot, get your own show, or you can come down and do voiceover work. There's so many lanes to choose. So when you get down here, you know, you gotta start to pick your lanes. And that's what I've tried to do since I moved to SoCal.
And then also see you navigating that space and knowing that there are particular gatekeepers, right? I would see that being challenging because you got to understand the who's who. But when I think about what's happening right now in the comedic space. You know, in recent years, we've seen increased representation and acclaim towards the work of Black women in entertainment, such as Issa Rae, Tiffany Haddish, and Ava DuVernay. What do you attribute to this moment of increased representation of Black women in entertainment? And do you feel that it's inclusive of queer Black women?
I think it is, to a point. I mean, everything has its limits. I think one of the things that I think helped of representation in Hollywood at this moment is that, you know, YouTube came along and the ability to make your own content. I mean, that's really how Issa Rae did it. I mean, she crowdfunded, she made her own show, and from there, she catapulted to Insecure. I mean, if you have the ability to make your own content, get eyes on it, have people see you and what you're capable of, I think that makes Hollywood take notice, and then you get to sort of navigate how you want to move in those spaces once you get there. So I think being able to create your own content has been key in this era for Black and queer creatives.
Talk a bit about the honesty required to create effective funny, like to be a good comedian, and the vulnerability and the level of honesty that needs to be on the mat in order for you to really penetrate the audience, for them to be like, have a good hearty laugh.
I think the number one thing you got to do is you got to be honest. I mean, audiences can, you know, they can sniff out a phony, and you got to be who you are. That's the number one thing. And number two, I think you have to put funny first. A lot of times, you know, I make jokes about, you know, things that have happened to me, racist things or sexist things or being queer, people doing things that were offensive to me. But it's like, if I can't make those things funny, they never get into my act. So I think that's number two. And I think number three is just, you know, that fondness you have for the art. That's really what drives you, because there's a lot of things that go on in this business before you ever hit the stage. So if you don't love it, you know, I mean, really have a passion for it, you won't make it. And you won't connect with the audience once you get on that stage.
I remember recently I watched some of your bits online, and there was a story you were talking about road rage.
100% true.
Since we getting to know each other so much, you guys, I'm gonna tell you guys something about me that I've been trying to fix. I have really, really bad road rage, and I'm trying to be better in 2024. But I was in the parking lot with the woman, and we came to a head, and I think she thought I was trying to beat her to a parking spot, and I wasn't. And she mouthed the word bitch to me, and so I just started following her around the parking lot. And when she stopped, I jumped out and I was like, what did you say to me? But then in that moment, I realized that that's not a healthy reaction, right? Because whatever happened, like, I shouldn't be going from 0 to 60 to this person that I don't even know I just met. You know, so it just happened again recently. A guy cut me off and he gave me the finger. And I realized that's what's triggering to me. Somebody doing something to me and then blaming me for it. And then I followed him around the parking lot. He jumped out, I jumped out. He was like, I don't want to get into a road rage thing with you. And I was like, road rage? I was like, get some of this road sage, sir. Like, let's clear this negative energy. Like, we both need therapy. Let's work this out together. Let's talk about it. Like, that's what I'm into 2024. Let's talk about it.
So what's next? What's coming up for you? What's the next thing on the horizon?
Right now, concentrating on writing. Got some, I'm co-writing with some other comics, and you know, we've been in touch with some production companies and they've given us notes, so we're kind of working on those. So that's what I've been concentrating on, and I really have some ideas in my head that I would love to see on TV or in a miniseries or a movie even.
I wish you the best with all of it, Corinda Dobbins. I really appreciate you, and thank you for speaking with me today here on Making Contact.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Again, I spoke with comedian Corinda Dobbins about her debut CD, Black and Blue, on Making Contact. If you want more information about her CD or about our weekly shows, you can visit us at focmedia.org. That's focmedia.org. Also, you can visit us on Twitter and on Instagram and leave us a comment. We would really like to hear from you. Again, I've been your host this week, Anita Johnson. Thanks so much for listening to Making Contact.
Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.